Tom Weber on NPR News. My next guests are pretty sure you've committed a crime, and you can learn from that. Emily Baxter heads an organization called We Are All Criminals and recently published a book of the same name. She spent the past few years gathering stories of people who got away with a crime. Well, that's most of us. Those who got a second chance after being convicted of a crime, and those who live in a perpetual cycle of incarceration. And so, here's something to remember. While one in four people in the U.S. has a criminal record, four in four people in the U.S. have a criminal past. Emily Baxter, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having us
on.
What
an interesting premise. We're going to dive into that for sure. Also joining me, Richard McLemore, who works with an organization called Ujamaa Place, which works with people after they leave the correction system. He's also on the board of We Are All Criminals. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you for having us.
I appreciate it. It's so provocative, Emily, to think about the one in four, but then the four in four of us have criminal pasts. Was there a light bulb moment? You know, you have the mind blown thing, that kind of a moment when you realized that and really took that to heart.
You know, I think that it was a confluence of events, but certainly one in particular. I had been a public defender, left public defense to work in public policy. I was working at the Council on Crime and Justice, and we held these expungement seminars at the Hennepin County Government Center. And late one night, there was a gentleman that came in who needed help with a criminal record, and it was a minor one. And I, being fresh off litigation and working as a public defender, was quite jaded at that point and dismissive of him and his pain and what he was going through, thinking that, you know, this can't be too much of a disruption to your life. Get over it. It's a misdemeanor theft, a petty misdemeanor theft is all it was. And I saw him just dissolve in front of me and explain to me that it wasn't just a minor inconvenience in his life, but it was a complete disruption. It had affected nearly every aspect of who he was and how he was able to move about the world, from personal to professional, from social to psychological. And in that moment, I realized not just how profound and pervasive and paralyzing criminal records can be, but I also realized the depth of my own privilege. That I had committed crimes very similar to those that he was convicted of. And yet I am judged by my merit rather than my mugshot. I don't need to justify my existence in the same way that this gentleman was forced to because of his criminal record.
Because you don't have a criminal record.
I do not have a criminal record.
But
no.
You have and a criminal past.
As do you.
As
yes.
do I.
As do
right.
we all.
What's
As
the importance, Richard, of making that? Ty, I mean, we've had conversations about the first part of what Emily just talked about mm-hmm. the cycle and the hardship that people have with that record of getting a job or finding housing. I mean, we've talked about that. What is the importance of then taking the next step to say, oh, and by the way, all the rest of you listening are actually the same people, but you don't have the record? Why is that important?
You know, that's very important because, you know, it has to be an all in or nothing. Keeping people barred from resources and opportunities that they need is really just continuing to widen that divide of people. And people have the way of justifying and really living with these disparities. But it becomes important to talk about it. It becomes important to have these conversations and bring it up and acknowledge it. Even if people don't want to acknowledge it publicly, then privately. But the conversation has to be had, because without the dialogue, the thought doesn't stop and it doesn't change. So it's very important that we have these conversations so folks like that we're talking about that have the privilege to forget, at least have to remember.
I think we should also clarify here, Emily, because I think every single person who drove to work today probably broke the law if we think about speed limits.
Speeding.
Right? but speeding doesn't necessarily lead to a criminal record, right? You get a ticket. And so I think it sounds like you're actually looking for something a little more. So maybe we'll take speeding out of that. Is that right or no?
No, that's right. I will, just as a footnote, say that things that you think of as non-offenses, like jaywalking or speeding, have led to fatal encounters for some people who are viewed as threats or dangers or criminals by the color of their skin. But leaving that discussion aside for just a moment, there is other low-hanging fruit. that I would encourage people to
search
to consider.
Their pasts.
Right. Smoking pot, for example, using someone else's prescription medication, keeping your own prescription medication from, say, a knee surgery for a friend who may have pulled their back or may have menstrual cramps or some other reason that they would be in need of pain medication, right? That's a felony for you to distribute it and a felony for them to take it. Taking office supplies home from work, walking out of a store without paying for something, piggybacking on a neighbor's cable or Wi-Fi, writing a check that bounces, driving home drunk or buzzed, throwing a punch even in middle school or high school, right? Those playground fights are now permanent records on individuals, or permanent mars on individuals' records. Illegally downloading music, buying booze for someone underage, using a fake ID, even if it is your siblings, that counts. You know, all of these things, they seem like forgettable offenses or forgettable moments in time. And yet, countless people are ensnared by engaging in this conduct and little more. And the way that our criminal justice system is set up, people who are caught up in the system, and these relatively minor offenses just are never let go.
And so in that spirit, as I talked to Emily Baxter and Richard McLemore, the new book is the same name as the organization that they're from here as well. It's called We Are All Criminals, and we're going to get into what the book actually does too. A lot of photos in there too. But I want to hear what your crime is. Fess up. This is our moment here. You too, Richard, but I want to hear the audience too.
Okay. As a brief aside, and as a former public defender, I would encourage people to be as vague as possible. And and I would also say that, you know, we're just engaging in story time now, so anything that is disclosed isn't necessarily.
Yeah.
You know,
this is not public. This is not going out over the airwaves. It's fine. But give us a call, 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. You can tweet me at WeberTom1. And don't call or text if you're driving, because, oh, by the way, if you've ever texted while driving in Minnesota since 2008, you've also broken the law. You're a criminal. So don't do it. Although, again, that's a traffic offense. So we will let the speeding and the texting while driving go for now. But to the list that Emily just talked about, et cetera, et cetera, the point of the book is to actually go out and find people to talk about this, Emily. First of all, how easy was that? Explain what you wanted to get out of this book.
Sure. First of all, it's bizarrely easy, something that surprised me. I thought that I would have a very difficult time finding people who were willing to disclose to me something that they've otherwise had the luxury to forget. But whether it's out of curiosity or catharsis or a need just to engage in the conversation, people have come forward and told me about crimes that they've committed. Some have been petty, some serious, some happened decades ago, and others a bit more recently. But nevertheless, it's been this fascinating last few years of collecting these stories of crime. And I think what's important in that, Tom, is that this isn't just some voyeuristic compilation.
No, I know.
But really, it's an examination of crime and criminality, of privilege and punishment. I ask people who have gotten away with crimes to really consider, through an examination of state statute, federal code, and broader social stigma, what life would be like had they been caught. And then importantly, also examine how race and class allowed them to skate through life unscathed by that particular reminder of that past act or acts.
And we were already getting calls. People are, to your point, it's very interesting. People are fascinated. I'll just give a couple examples from the book. There was a person who now works at a school who, when he or she was younger, would get with his, I'm going to guess it's a he, but that's just my stereotypes and my bias here. But he would get with his friends and put together this concoction they would call napalm, and they would basically throw it against the wall of the school, and it would burn. It didn't burn the school down, but it was basically this thing where you throw something like this napalm thing against the wall and the side of the building burns for a few minutes. Mm-hmm. Well, that's arson.
arson, it turns out, is quite popular.
And yes, quite easy to commit. You don't have, the thing doesn't have to burn down for it to be arson.
Kids are pyromaniacs. Oh, a lot of people before their brains are fully developed love lighting things on fire, love blowing things up, be it this, you know, lighting the side of a school building on fire, you know, marking your territory, if you will.
That's one way to call
blowing up a mailbox, also very common, and bizarrely porta potties. People love destroying porta potties. Isn't that bizarre?
You know, and actually with mailboxes, it's a federal
crime.
You know, if you take the baseball bat, you're in the car and you whack them. I mean, those mailboxes are believe it or not, because of the Postal Service being federal, mailboxes have federal protection. Why does it matter, Richard, that this person set a wall on fire, right, when he was a kid? Draw the line to how the fact that he never got caught is then privilege, right? I mean, draw the line to why we then talk about him having privilege over someone else.
Okay, because if this young man who has a luxury to forget that they took a cocktail and threw it off a wall, not really knowing what could happen if anyone's in that building, and then they're allowed to go home, have dinner with their family, move on with their life, continue in probably the same school that they just assaulted, go to college and do something very productive and important with their life, where the other person we're talking about, young person or young adult, even older adult, is caught, punished, given some type of criminal record, either going to prison or some other type of sanction that's never forgotten because now it's documented. So that individual has a different track, a different trajectory with their life automatically just because it's on paper, just because it's on the internet, just because it's public information now. So it is going to bar him from that same life course that the individual that could get past it and forget about it because it's just a personal story now that they talk about.
Hey, guess what I did when
I was a kid, man. You know, oh, yeah, I did that. Wow, how did you make we did it the same way. How did you do that before the internet? You know what I mean? It becomes just a conversation where a person really I say like myself is constantly held accountable for something that they may have done years, a lot of times decades ago.
The fact that Emily, the fact that in that moment there were no police to see these kids doing this against the building. I mean, we're talking about a slightly different kind of privilege than I think people might think about when you think about racial privilege. I know it comes back to that. I don't want to lose that trace. But the fact that you throw something against a building and it catches on fire and there were no police there in that moment, that in and of itself, Emily, does not rely on whether you're white or black, right? Or does it?
I would say that there's a, you know, in the Venn diagram of privilege, there's a strong overlap there. Absolutely. There are neighborhoods that are very highly policed and those that
and
are
patrolled.
Not. And the neighborhood that I grew up in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, I'm a middle class white woman, was not highly policed.
So if you're a white kid growing up, you know you can go do this because you never see cops around patrolling, for example.
Sure. I mean, that was a pretty bold statement. I don't think I would
I'm happy to make bold
painted
statements
that broadly.
Yeah.
I would say, though, that there's a large portion of the U.S. population that does not see police in their schools, that does not see police on the corner, that does not see police in their parks. And then there's a large portion of the U.S. population that does. A portion of the population, poor, black, and brown, and indigenous people who are constantly aware of that police presence and who are in turn viewed as criminals, again, just by their mere existence. And so I do think that there's a very strong overlap.
What would you add, Richard?
Yes. And, you know, to add to that, you know, one of the things that I've always pushed is that police need to live in the communities that they work in. In middle class white neighborhoods, a police officer doesn't mind residing in a neighborhood that they may police in and having the community represent as their neighbor. But you don't see police in the inner city. You don't see St. Paul cops. You don't see Minneapolis cops that live in the city usually. They live on the outskirts. They live in the suburbs. They can get away from what they have to do professionally. And that is a big difference, because if you don't know the law enforcement in your neighborhood and you don't know that that's, you know, Tom down the street or Mike or whoever on first name basis, because before they're an officer, they played baseball or they're in your community. It's a lot different than when you're being in St. Paul and growing up in the neighborhood I grew up in, where you know no police because the only time they're in your neighborhood is when they're really messing with you. That's the only understanding you have of them.
And we're listening. Were you going to add something there?
I was just going to say that I think it's important to note that in the book, there are stories of individuals who have criminal histories, but not criminal records. So in other words, people who have not been arrested, prosecuted, convicted, but people who have had interactions with police, and the interactions have been innocuous. They have been generous. They have been kind. There are examples of good policing out there. I myself have experienced good policing. You can address someone's wrongdoings. You can provide consequences without eviscerating a person, his or her family, in future too. And the way that our criminal justice system is set up right now, it's like we don't know any other way of doing that. With a large section of the population. So policing itself isn't necessarily bad. You know, there are examples of good policing out there. Mm-hmm. It's just that, unfortunately, not everybody in our society benefits from that.
There was the person who's now a restaurant manager who in his or her earlier days stole from the tip jar. And the then manager caught him or her and said, you can either sign over your current check now to refund us or to reimburse us, or I will call the police. And so you turn over the check. So nothing happened. Nothing came of it other than you lost that week's check. That person's now a restaurant manager.
She is.
She is. Okay.
And if you look at that picture, Tom, in the book, it may remind you of another photo in the book. And the photo that it echoes quite intentionally is that of the gentleman who inspired the project, the gentleman that I told you about in the beginning, the one with the petty misdemeanor theft. Mm-hmm. So there's a man who was caught stealing, and he went, Anthony, the gentleman who inspired the book, is a Black man, and he was caught, he was prosecuted, and he will be perpetually punished for that incident. And the white woman, the restaurant manager, who was also caught but had a different set of circumstances, a different set of consequences, learned her lesson and rerouted her life and has been able to thrive. And so there's a reason why those two photos intentionally echo one another. Those are the where paths diverge.
Let's take some calls here as well, people sharing their crimes, even if you don't have the criminal record. I'm interested to know what's in your past as you listen to this conversation. John in Minneapolis, what are you guilty of, John, even if you're not officially guilty of it?
Well, this has to go to the herbal topic. And, you know, since I'm Caucasian, grew up in the Midwest, small town, and I remember how hard it used to be to get this specific herb when I was a teenager. And now, as an adult, 36 years old, the ability to go to states where it's legal and then come back to states where it's not, and actually bring small amounts in checked luggage. And I recently just had a conversation with a friend who talked about taking what were legal substances in one state to another state via airplane. In his checked luggage, and the TSA went through his bag and found the batteries and left a note telling him not to let the batteries or not to check the batteries, but didn't touch the connecting ports that contained the illegal substance. And in sort of researching this, this is a common occurrence where the substance is illegal, but say the TSA is more interested in planes being blown up than they are about transporting small amounts of illegal material. So I just think that's an interesting, and that friend happens to not be a Caucasian person. So, you know, the race wasn't an issue there, but I'd love to hear what your guests have to say about just legality and how it's sort of across state lines can be a different matter.
Thanks so much. Before I get your responses, that I want to take a couple more calls just to get a few under our belt, and then we can react to them. This next caller wants to remain anonymous here in St. Paul.
Likewise.
Good morning. What would you like to add here?
Hi. I actually am finding this just an amazing topic. I, middle-class Caucasian mom, hit some pretty substantial financial hard times, and I ventured into the world of escorting. And I recall, and I'm a rule follower, like I cross at crosswalks, and that's like I completely respect consequence for actions. And I remember every night knowing that I could get caught, and I could, I mean, the whole trajectory of my life would completely change. But the risk and weighing that out to me, for however intense it was, seemed to be worth it.
And so you were never caught.
I was never caught. And it was interesting to me, the infrastructure, like I was not the only, like there are many Caucasian moms pulling this second gig to survive, and the infrastructure that is set up, particularly here around the cities because of the airports and all of that. It was amazing to me how many of us took the risk to quote unquote commit that crime, wow, to kind of get ourselves out of a place.
Go ahead. Thank you so much for calling. It's very intriguing to hear that as well. And I'm going to take one more here. Kim, in Hastings. Hi, Kim. What would you add?
Yes. Hi. Well, I do have a criminal record. Very unlikely. I'm a 59-year-old white woman, affluent, attempting to divorce my husband a couple years ago. He thought that he could one-up me with taking out a harassment restraining order in Washington County, which this particular female judge upheld. And then he was in a position to set me up to violate it, which when you go in on a Friday afternoon, no judge releases you until Monday. So I was wearing orange for 3 days. I consider it my 3-day Stillwater staycay. And my daughters believe it's like it's a stand-up comedy routine now with my book club women. But my daughters do believe that their father can do no wrong, so mom must be a criminal. This has impacted my ability to now get employment. I cannot enter Canada, and I have friends there and family because along with drunken driving, DUIs, those are offenses in Canada. So I can't enter Canada, and I can't even expunge my record for another year. And this is violating a harassment restraining order, and from my independent reading, they're taken out willy-nilly all the time. And if you get the wrong judge, and I did have a very biased woman judge, and my husband cried crocodile tears, told her I had a gun and a taser. She believed it, chose to believe him, and it's really sucks for me.
Well, Kim, thanks for sharing that. I appreciate you calling. You had some heads nodding here in the studio. Emily, so we heard three people there. He was talking about marijuana. Can we just say that? He's talking about marijuana, the woman who became an escort, and then the 59-year-old woman who got into what she calls this trap here around these restraining orders.
Yeah. First of all, thank you so much to all three of the callers for sharing.
Yes.
I really appreciate that. And I think that, you know, one thing that kind of binds this book and this project together and really fuels it is understanding that facts may not change people's minds, but stories do. And so thank you for being generous with yours. I do want to just note on the call about marijuana. I think it's important when we're considering, so many states that are now legalizing or decriminalizing at least small amounts of marijuana, that there are people who are still in prison for engaging in same or similar behavior. There are still people who are laboring under the suffocating stigma of a criminal record right now. People who cannot get into school, people that cannot get into housing, people that cannot find jobs, people who cannot cast a ballot in their local election, people who cannot travel to Canada, people whose lives are significantly disrupted for engaging again in that same behavior that is now legalized or decriminalized in many other jurisdictions.
So your point there is that if we're going to legalize it, that's not the only conversation to have.
Absolutely.
You have to have the next conversation about
the population.
Sure.
I mean, you look at Colorado, right, for example. And
where
there has been, and there's been this incredible industry boom. And yet the people who have licenses to sell are generally people who have not been selling it, right? People who, so you have a lot of white entrepreneurs who are coming in and making bank on this. Meanwhile, you have just a few miles down the road, black and brown people who are in prison for engaging in the same behavior.
Same exact stuff.
And who upon release will be locked out of licensure because of, again, the series of collateral consequences. And I think that just understanding to our last caller's point, just how pervasive those consequences are, it's so important. You think you do the crime, you do the time. But what people don't understand is that because of these criminal records, it's a sentence that does not end. It's a time that never runs.
It's quite a brain game to play about saying, if we're going to legalize marijuana, should we let people who are licensed to do it be people who used to deal it? I mean, it seems like you have a natural population of people who would be good at it, but that's a conversation for another day. But what would you add?
It's logical.
It is. Let's go back to the phones here. Tara in Minneapolis. What would you like to share? We have a lot of calls here. A lot of people actually really do want to share, Emily, to your point.
Great.
Tara.
I love hearing it.
Go right ahead.
Hi. So when I was in college, back in a small town in the Midwest, I was very, very poor. I was living on my own, going to school full time, and I had found myself with zero money until my next payday. And I went to the grocery store and I shoplifted about $20 worth of groceries. And about 10 years after that, once I was doing, you know, working, I went back to the small town to pay them back. I was going to pay them $50, you know, I was figuring interest, but the store had closed down. So I never got to kind of, you know,
no closure.
Pay my due. Yeah. So I'm coming clean.
I appreciate it. I appreciate the call. Let's go to another call here in Duluth. Someone else who wants to stay anonymous. Hi, what would you like to add?
Well, I just, I'd like to, first of all, reflect on the need that I feel and the previous caller felt to be anonymous as reflective of, you know, what people have to carry who do have criminal records.
Yes.
I do have a criminal record, I'm actually on the predatory offender registry. Mm. And so I really just wanted to add that extra layer to this conversation. But my main point, and that's a whole topic in itself. My main point is the stigma that that ripples out to anyone who's made an offense, and the people that then support them. And you know, I've chosen to stay in the community where I formerly offended, and I've tried to reengage. I'm living healthfully, living rightfully, trying to do what I can to make healing without hurting But the people who around me and support me and know who I am now sometimes feel the effects. And I just wanted to share my love with those people through this venue, I guess.
Thank you for the call there. Richard, I mean, you do some of this work with Ujamaa Place, too.
I do.
Just reflections on what you heard there.
You know, It's a tough pill to swallow having a what they use the acronym SO case, you know, being on a registry, having to subject your life to it being combed through continuously at every step of the way. It's funny because we were talking about those Molotov cocktails and just, you know, the playfulness of throwing them off a building. But what's interesting is that arson and SO crimes, as they say, are the two most highly restrictive criminal backgrounds you can have. And what I mean is you are barred out almost completely from housing, employment, opportunities for school. I mean, it is incredibly tough having this on your record. And what folks don't understand is that something like public in urination will get you this same charge, and you will be considered as a sex offender. You will be
for public urination.
Yes, because you've exposed yourself in public, and there's no you're in public, so you will have to register. You will have to subject yourself to going to the police station when you move and let them know that you're moving in a community. When they have a community meeting, you may be a person whose name comes up. Yes, it's an incredibly hard pill to swallow because it's so
it's so encompassing, and they put so many things under that charge, and it's devastating.
And so, if the guy throwing the Molotov cocktails, if he and his friends had been caught, and one of them happened to be 18. That's an arson charge, and I didn't realize that about.
Oh, Tom, it doesn't matter if you're 18 or not.
Sure,
you know, I think that's an important part of the conversation as well. Is that we criminalize behavior here in Minnesota starting at age 10. In some jurisdictions, there is no floor. A child as young as 3 can have their actions criminalized. So, what occurs or allegedly occurs when you're underage is still considered a crime. It's considered a juvenile violation. But that crime, so if you have a 16-year-old who is caught blowing something up or burning down a building or lighting mm-hmm. something ablaze, that arson charge can be something that they carry with them for the rest of their lives. And if it, it could potentially be a public record, that's kind of a nuance for another time. But even if it's a private record, mm-hmm. it doesn't just magically disappear when one turns 18. That's a record that can determine whether they can work, say, with vulnerable individuals when they're 30.
You know, I have a relative who set a vacant lot on fire when he was like 9 in the 50s. Mm. And nothing came of it. Having to fess up to the, I mean, it was his mom, my grandma, saying, come on, drag by the ear, you're going to go fess up to the fire chief, and the fire chief wagging the finger. That was punishment enough. He went on to be a scientist at a national lab, right?
Wow.
PhD.
Wow.
So he didn't have any arson on his.
He never had a problem.
We talked about it. We regaled the story. Remember when you set that lot on fire? I mean, nobody got hurt. It was an empty lot, et cetera, et cetera. You don't think about that.
Can you imagine, him going to apply for a school and getting denied, applying for that job after college and getting denied, looking for a place to live while he's in school or after school and getting denied. I'm almost positive he wouldn't be doing what he is today.
Yeah. He's retired happily, actually, today. He had his career. He's done. He's good. You know, in thinking about this, Emily, for this show, I thought about whether I'm going to tell my story, and I'm going to, and it's because when I reflect on it, I mean, there have been probably 2 or 3 times in my life when I've driven and I had too much to drink, and I know that if I had gotten pulled over, it would have been bad. And it was many years ago. Nothing came of it. I never hit anybody. I never got pulled over. But when even all those years ago that it happened when I was young, when I think about it, I feel a lot of shame.
Yeah, absolutely.
I did that.
Yeah. The stories that we've collected in this book, they're not all celebrations of criminality, although certainly some of the people who share their stories are quite proud of what they've done. Some of it, like I said, is more of a catharsis, people wanting mm-hmm. to talk about something that they've done that doesn't sit well with them. And going back to another point that we expressed in the beginning, this project, this conversation isn't about a lack of consequences. It's ensuring that, it's preventing harm when we can, and when we cannot prevent harm, responding to it through a series of consequences, responses that are reasonable and rational and equitable and perhaps most importantly, merciful. We have to be We have to allow people a sense of hope that there is an end to the punishment. Now, I do think that our criminal code is so overbroad that we can more than have it and still have too much on the books. But that said, for those offenses that do truly harm another person, I think that there's a way that we can create a system of consequences that doesn't just eviscerate that person.
Let's get a couple calls. We only have about 2 minutes left, so if you can be brief, I'd love to hear your story. But Jimmy in Minneapolis, what's your story here in our last few minutes? Hi, Jimmy. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, during the fall, we have a tradition where we hang dry corn up around our post light in the front yard. Our backyard butts up against a cornfield. And when it is dried out, we would go back and we would take corn out of the cornfield. And when I say we, me and my two younger sons now, they are adults now.
Mm-hmm.
And what we would do is we would drop a handful of porters into the dirt.
To pay for the corn. They probably got picked up by the machines and the combines and stuff, messed up all of that.
But what I didn't realize at the time, since then, because they're grown men now, is that that was a form of white privilege. Because I knew that if somebody was going to catch us doing it, I could tell them the story.
Yeah.
And they would let me go. Yeah. And I'm not sure that would happen with anybody else.
In our final minute here, to your point, we have a call. We're not going to get to it, unfortunately. We have so many calls here. People really wanted to tell their story. We only have a minute left here. Someone who was peeing in a park, and the cops did try to get him on that, and he would have been a sex offender, but he fought it and he won. We have a lot of misdemeanors here, people who can't find jobs and things like that, and you know, breaking and entering, you know, Jean Valjean kind of stuff from Les Mis. 40 seconds left here, Emily. What do you hope people get from this exercise when they think about this?
So for the 3 in 4 people in the United States, and specifically here in Minnesota, who do not have a criminal record, I encourage you to consider your criminal history and consider the context that you allow yourself. I was young, I was drunk, I was stupid, I was in a bad relationship, I gave it back anyway, no one got hurt, it wasn't my idea. Understand that that may have existed for someone who was caught or accused as well. It may not be an excuse, but it is an opportunity to recognize the common humanity. And for those who do have a record, understand that you are not alone.
Yes, very good.
The book is called We Are All Criminals. Emily Baxter, Richard McLemore, thank you so much for being here. I appreciate
it. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you for having us.